Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly guide to all the top trends in technology. I'm Rory Catherine-Jones, and this week the theme of artificial intelligence runs through just about all of the stories we'll discuss. We'll hear how America's Facebook and China's Baidu are investing heavily in AI to transform their businesses. And we meet the man who predicted the huge disruption automation would cause in a book called The Second Machine Age. Joining me is BBC technology reporter Zoe Kleinman. Hi, Zoe.
Hello, Rory.
Good to have you back on the show. And my special guest this week is Tom Standage, deputy editor of The Economist, formerly its technology editor and author of a number of books, giving a historical perspective on technology. Welcome, Tom.
Hello.
Good to have you here. Here's a flavour of what's coming up.
The technology is advancing faster. It's creating more wealth than I anticipated. I think they've caught even the AI and machine learning people off guard.
I mean, it's a kind of a Chinese-US company, often described as the Chinese Google. It is the number one search engine in this country.
First, though, we've had another insight this week into the vast ambitions of Facebook, many of them focused on its heavy investment in artificial intelligence. At its F8 developer conference, the social network outlined plans to advance in a number of areas of new technology, including, wait for it, mind control. Zoe Kleinman, take us through the headlines from that conference.
Well, the biggest and possibly the most spooky headline, I think, was Facebook's claim that it's developing software that will be able to decode our thoughts using what it calls a silent speech interface.
Can it tell what I'm thinking right now?
Well,
which is that is scary.
I wish I could. Not all our thoughts, it says, only those which we wish to share, which is a relief, although I don't know how you're going to sort of make that clear within your thought patterns. Oh, it's driving me mad just thinking about it. Its ambition for Messenger is that lots of other applications are going to be integrated with it, so you won't have to leave that platform to do other things. And it also revealed hopes that we might one day meet our Facebook friends in virtual reality avatar form via its Oculus Rift platform.
Thanks. A lot going on at that conference. And there was a lot of emphasis on the Facebook Messenger service, which last year became a platform for all sorts of AI-powered chatbots, small pieces of software which could do everything from serve you up a news bulletin to order you a takeaway. Our man in Silicon Valley, Dave Lee, met the man in charge of Messenger, David Marcus, and asked him whether the impact of these chatbots had been a bit disappointing.
Well, you know, it's always like that. You know, at first, people overestimate what things might happen in a short few months, and they underestimate what will happen over the very long run. Now, and this is no exception. So it takes time for an ecosystem to be built. As I said, we have 100,000 developers now building for Messenger, and it was 33,000 just last September. So the ecosystem is really going strong. And we've learned a lot, and businesses are now finding success on the platform across a variety of use cases, from acquiring customers to raising brand awareness to providing customer support and even financial services.
Many of the new features on Messenger and across Facebook's various products, they're very similar to Snapchat, aren't they? Extremely similar. And people are saying that Snapchat are innovating and Facebook's just coming along with its big resources and copying it. Is that fair?
I don't think it is. I think, you know, they definitely invented a format, the stories format, and I definitely think that it feels right at home in a messaging app where setting the context of what you're up to before a conversation is actually providing a lot of utility for people. Or you can use it as a way to broadcast plans that you might want to make on Messenger later. So you can shoot a photo of yourself and say, who's up for coffee? And then people can respond to that, and you can actually make the plan in the very place where you would have made the plans in the very first place. So, you know, I think it actually fits right at home. But like the focus we have right now during this F8 and in the past 12 months from a platform standpoint is really to empower a thriving developer ecosystem to build experiences that people will want to have on Messenger, because it actually is better to have them there than anywhere else.
But in terms of what Facebook themselves are adding, it's very similar to Snapchat, isn't it? I mean, but is that working? We heard recently, didn't we, about huge usage figures for Messenger, also for Instagram, bigger than the daily active users on Snapchat. So are you taking users from Snapchat? Do you think, is that working, taking those young people across?
Well, but that's not the goal, right?
But is it happening?
I don't know, because I only track numbers on my own product. But what I can tell you is that for teens, And for a bunch of different demographics, this is a utility that they're now using on a regular basis on Messenger to set more context for conversations to come. And we think that's extremely valuable, and we're going to continue investing in it. And as you've seen today at the keynote, with our AR and camera platforms, we'll bring richer and richer ways to share across all of our products, and I'm really excited about this.
It's Facebook's David Marcus talking to Dave Lee. Our special guest is Tom Standage from The Economist. Tom, a huge investment in AI in Facebook, but is there any sign it's having an impact, or frankly, are they just focused on squashing Snapchat?
Well, they're actually the same thing, because what Snapchat does is very heavily reliant on machine learning, machine vision technology. When you use all those funny lenses that, you know, give you rabbit ears and things like that in Snapchat, you can see how complicated that is. It does that kind of mesh over your face and you can see what it's doing. All of this is, you know, coming out of the same research labs that are producing the AI technology that's going into so many other things. So to do things like floating, 3D stickers in space, which is what Snapchat have just added. You know, obviously Facebook will be unveiling their version of that in a week or two, I suppose, and that requires a lot of this, technology.
So it's not a kind of a vanity project, AI. It's actually core to Facebook's future. Is that what you're saying?
It is, and they use it for lots of other things, for placing ads, obviously, in some countries, although not in Europe. When you upload a picture, it tries to guess who's in it. It does facial recognition. So there is an enormous amount of technology. It's just, it's not always visible. What it does is just make products like Facebook or Google or other search engines just a bit better, a bit smarter. And so in that sense, it's sort of invisible. It's just inside everything, making it a bit better. So you can't always tell when something you're using has been improved by AI, but very often it has.
And we'll be coming back to AI later in the programme. Now, let's have a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Zoe Kleinman. Zoe, Tesla's had an amazing few weeks. It's worth more than General Motors, but suddenly some not so good news.
Yeah, Tesla's issued a voluntary global recall for some of its Model S and X cars. It wants to fix a potential problem with the electric parking brake. It says about 2% of 53,000 vehicles built between February and October last year may have been affected, but it's recalling all of them as a precaution. It blamed a third-party supplier for the potential issue and says there have not been any reports of any accidents related to it. So it's really kind of just, you know, erring on the side of caution. Didn't affect its shares price too much. They fell by about 1%
after
the news.
It's extraordinary how robust its share price has been lately. What's been the good news for internet users in Cameroon?
The good news is that the net is back, Rory. It was restored on Thursday, 3 months after it was cut off in English-speaking regions in reaction to protests about the imposition of French language in schools and the marginalisation of the English-speaking population of Cameroon, which makes up about 20% of the people that live there. Before the ban, authorities warned mobile phone users they faced jail for spreading false information. Needless to say, communications and the economy were both very badly affected by the shutdown.
Surprise, surprise, the internet matters to an economy. And why is a juice extractor causing some to wonder whether Silicon Valley has lost its marbles?
Imagine this, Rory. Your firm has just landed $120 million in funding and everyone's talking about your exciting new product. You'd be popping the champagne, right?
Yeah, sure.
Except, a word of caution, those bubbles have turned out to be rather flat for the boss of a San Francisco startup called Juicero. It's now offering a refund on its $399 Wi-Fi connected juicing machine.
$399?
Yeah. It used to cost
$700. Tom Standage is obviously a customer.
They've come down. Well, I think there were a range of them. It started at $399, which is still, I think, quite a lot for a juicing machine. After it was pointed out on social media that you can get the same drink out of the $8 fruit packs simply by squeezing them with your own hands. Chief exec Jeff Dunn said the criticism overlooked the experience of using the device, and he also described the hand squeezing as a hack, and that hasn't gone down very well either.
Tom, this is just the latest example of Silicon Valley going bonkers. I mean, any old thing being described as a sort of, you know, a high-tech startup, just you stick an app on it and it's worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes, I can't imagine what the Wi-Fi connector does on a juicer. But in this case, though, there is an even bigger example of collective silliness that you don't even need technology for it. And that is the multi-billion-dollar bottled water industry, where people in the developed world who have perfectly good perfectly clean, perfectly safe water coming out of their taps, choose not to use it and to buy much more expensive bottles that have to be shipped around in lorries and end up in landfills instead. So I think that's a much bigger example of sort of collective liquid drink idiocy than the juicer. But the juicer story is quite funny.
It certainly is. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, the Chinese search giant with big ambitions to make driverless cars. First, though, in 2014, a book came out which sparked debate around the world about the impact of rapid advances in technology on our working lives. It was called The Second Machine Age, and one of its authors was Professor Erik Brynjolfsson from MIT in Boston. While the book warned that many jobs could be lost to automation, it was more optimistic about employment than some others. Now, Professor Brynjolfsson has co-authored a new book, Machine Platform Crowd, about the next stage of this automation revolution. I met him in Oxford this week and asked whether things were going better or worse than he'd predicted.
The good news is the technology is advancing faster. It's creating more wealth than I anticipated. I think they've caught even the AI and machine learning people off guard by, for instance, the advances in cars and recognizing faces and so forth. On the other hand, I have to say I'm disappointed on the political side. We haven't made the adjustments we needed to make. More and more people are being left behind. And instead of responding in a way that creates shared prosperity, I think there's been a lot of anger and destruction. You see the recent elections in America and maybe perhaps coming up in France and elsewhere, where people are taking out that anger on other people, on other nationalities. And that's not a constructive way to address these challenges.
Why are you linking that anger and, you know, those causes for anger with the advances in technology? Is there actually data out there showing that people's lives are being changed for the worse by any of this?
Yeah, we showed some of the data in the book, and since then I think there's been a tidal wave of additional data, and majority of economists come around to the view that while the pie is getting bigger, many people are being left behind. So my good friend and colleague Daron Acemoglu, who was a bit of a skeptic when I first came out with the book, came out with a paper just 2 or 3 weeks ago called Robots and Jobs, and he's changed his opinion, as John Maynard Keynes did when the new facts were available. And he now sees automation as being something that's hurting wages for a lot of middle-income workers and factory workers and hurting job opportunities. Larry Katz, editor of the Quarterly Journal of Economics, has said that when you compare, say, the effects of automation to globalization, quote, it's not even close. Most of the effect is due to the way technology is affecting jobs.
But where are you actually seeing concrete evidence? In which industries are you seeing evidence of that impact? I mean, you've talked about driverless cars. There's a lot of advancement made in the technology, but there's very little evidence of it actually out there on the road and taking people's jobs away.
Driverless cars is something we're going to see in the future, and that's part of why I'm concerned, because I think the biggest waves are yet to hit. Despite that, if you look at jobs in a lot of middle-skill routine information processing work, things like travel agents or bank managers or clerks, those kinds of jobs have been increasingly automated, and it shows up in the data where the wages have been falling for those middle-skill routine information processing jobs. The number of job openings have been falling, and as a result, we're seeing median income stagnating. That's the income at the 50th percentile. One of the important effects of that is that it's not just an economic issue. Increasingly, it's a social and even health problem.
So it's not so much that the robots are taking our jobs, it's that they're making the lives of a lot of people who are still in work worse or less prosperous?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I want to clarify a common myth, which is the idea that robots are taking all the jobs and soon there won't be any jobs left. I think that's profoundly mistaken. Today and for the next decade or two, the real challenge isn't robots taking all the jobs, but robots changing the kind of work that is in demand. Many new jobs are being created in data science, in creative areas, personal care and health care, in education, and there's no shortage of work that can only be done by humans. And we need to be more nimble, more agile about training people, changing our education, changing our economic system to make it easier for people to transition to those new jobs as the old jobs get eliminated.
Erik Brynjolfsson, Tom Standage, is he right about the economic impact of AI? Because it's actually quite hard to see right now, isn't it?
Yes, it is, very much so. I think he is. I think, you know, there's a spectrum. On the one hand, there are the sort of the classical economists who go, this will be fine in the long run, and unfortunately we have to live in the short term. But essentially, you know, they look at history and they say this will be fine. And then at the other end of the spectrum...
Because past technological waves have always been predicted to wipe out
exactly.
jobs.
Exactly. It's a very, very long... I mean, every decade of the 20th century, you can find newspaper headlines that say, oh, my God, the machines are coming, we're all going to lose our jobs, what will happen? And it didn't happen. And as Erik pointed out, it's very easy to see the jobs that are being lost when they are being lost. You know, factories, you know, car factories don't need as many workers as they used to, for example. But it's very hard to predict the new jobs that technology will produce in the future. I mean, if you look at what happened 200 years ago, the Industrial Revolution, people were very worried about this. There was a very similar debate to what's happening today. And people had no idea that things like trains were coming and the use of electricity, the telecoms industry, none of those cars, I mean, all of these new industries were about to pop up. And
the point he makes is that despite that, there are pockets of people, important pockets of people, who are definite losers.
So what this does is it means that where automation changes the skill mix of jobs, and that's really what's happening here, people who are doing jobs today might not have the kinds of skills that you need to do those jobs tomorrow. And they then have to take lower paid work than they would otherwise have taken. They end up doing, you know, low paid service work and so on. And what that does is it pushes, it means that median wages stagnate, and it also means you get more inequality, but you don't get more unemployment. It's just people are pushed down into sort of lower skilled jobs. They're underemployed, they're not using the skills they have, and they don't have the new skills that you need to do the new version of their job. And this is why lots of people in this field think that the answer is, you know, essentially more support for retraining and, in fact, using the very technology that's causing the problem to help people learn new skills.
Briefly, the politicians don't seem to be taking it seriously. As you said, we had the US Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, a few weeks ago saying, oh, this is something for 50 or 100 years ago.
Exactly. So the politicians find it much more convenient to blame foreigners, to blame immigrants, to blame China, and rather than saying, well, this is a terribly complicated economic argument to do with automation. And the other thing is that politicians are generally in favour of companies investing in technology because that improves productivity, it's investment in capital and so on. But the immediate impact of that is that it pushes some people into lower paid work. And so that puts you in a very difficult position as a politician. You want to encourage investment and you want to encourage greater productivity, but you don't want to be seen as supporting the companies that are, you know, pushing people out of their jobs. So it's not that surprising from a political point of view that the politicians have been so quiet about this.
And that is a debate that's going to continue and feature in every election campaign for the next few decades, one imagines.
Or not. They're just going to talk about the immigrants instead. I mean, that's the problem.
We must move on. Now, this week, a company which invests heavily in artificial intelligence and in driverless cars announced that it was opening up its autonomous vehicle research for the world to use. Now, that sounds like it could be Google, but it was, in fact, the Chinese internet search giant Baidu, which made that announcement at the Shanghai Auto Show. I spoke to our correspondent in Shanghai, Robin Brandt, and put it to him that most people outside China would be surprised to hear that Baidu was a force in the motor industry.
That's true, but Baidu is big. It's very big. I mean, it's a kind of a Chinese-US company, often described as the Chinese Google. It was founded about 17 years ago. It is the number one search engine in this country. I mean, it used to dominate the market up in the kind of 70-80%. Now it's about half of all searches on Baidu. And it does more than just search. It does maps, it does space. And as you've just alluded to, it's trying to be at the very forefront of developing autonomous car technology. It's invested a lot of money, not just here, in R&D and testing. It has tested on the streets of Beijing. It's a Beijing-based company, but lots of money as well in the States, in California, where much of the effort and resources goes in to trying to perfect this technology.
Now, it's made a bit of a splash at the motor show there. Were people taking it seriously as compared with the other obviously well-known car giants that were there?
Yes. I mean, look, you know, Baidu is not a car manufacturer, but it's a very, very, very well-known brand name here. As I say, it dominates search here, so it's very well-known. And this has been the the most eye-catching news story that's emerged at the beginning of this week-long auto show. And that's not just because they're Baidu, but it's because of the nature of what they're doing in opening up their technology and saying they'll share it with pretty much anyone who wants to use it as a platform for autonomous cars in the future. I mean, there's no one else really who has made that kind of a pledge. And they are being taken seriously because they are such big players. They have the resources. And as I've said, they are the market leader in terms of almost kind of brand recognition in the tech field in China. And speak to any serious play in the automotive industry, or perhaps I should describe it more as the mobility industry now. That's what VW, that's what Ford are all about. They're not just into cars. I've interviewed a couple of CEOs recently, and they know that China is the biggest car market in the world. And if you're going to make it, you need to make it here.
And is China going to lead the world in actually adopting driverless car technology? I think there's a sudden pause in optimism about this around the world. But does China believe that, you know, people will be sitting in the back of cars being driven around automatically in the near future?
Well, I'll give you a kind of a slightly more less serious personal answer to that first. Step outside onto the roads here, pretty chaotic. I'm not quite sure whether this is the place to develop and test autonomous cars. Having said that, the need is perhaps most desperate almost here, because there are huge problems with congestion. There are huge problems with the inability of public transport systems to cope with the number of people who just need to get around here. There are huge problems with pollution. So in a way, this is the best place to kind of test and then roll out this technology, because this is the place that does need it most.
Robin Brandt in Shanghai. Tom Standage, is China making big progress in AI?
It's certainly giving the US a good run for its money. There's an enormous number of engineers coming out of the universities, and there's a lot of cross-fertilization between the US and the Chinese AI communities, a surprising amount actually. And the sort of avatar of that is Andrew Ng, who was at Google and worked on Google Brain and then went to Baidu and has built up their AI division there, including the driverless cars, and has just said a couple of weeks ago that he's leaving and he's expected to go back to Silicon Valley and work there. So
Watch where he ends up.
Exactly.
Zoe Kleinman, briefly, you've been writing about another big AI theme this week. Algorithms could be just as biased as humans.
Yeah, it turns out that the data sets that we're using to train our algorithms are based predominantly, it seems, on white examples and white people. So the best way to explain this is to try it out. Put the word babies or hands or feet into a search engine. Look at the images you get. They're all going to be white. They're all white babies, white hands, white feet. And there's a growing sense of concern that these algorithms are just not recognising other races, and that this could be a problem when they do things like, you know, decide whether you're going to have a loan or what healthcare you need.
One of the many interesting themes around AI, which we'll continue to explore on the programme. That's all we've got time for. Thanks to Zoe Kleinman, my colleague from BBC Technology. You can read all of our stories at bbc.com/technology. Thanks to my special guest, Tom Standage from The Economist. Don't forget about our podcast. Tell all your friends about our podcast. And don't forget to join us in the tech tent at the same time next week.
Thank you for downloading from the BBC World Service. You can find a whole world of information from science, arts, business and technology. Just go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.